Okay. All righty. Last week we had gotten up to where Christianity was the official religion of the empire, and everybody was just doing fine, and it looked like peace was going to reign on the land. But there are problems when anything becomes the official thing of the government, even in Rome. And part of what we're going to look at this week is really what happened when Christianity became the official religion in Rome. And we're going to go this week up until hopefully we'll cover, if I do this correctly, we'll get all the way up to pretty much the fall of Rome. And then next week we'll start looking at the fall of Rome, the beginning of the medieval period and whatnot as we sort of go through this. But Constantine, you know, had his vision of the cross, which he believed was a key event in his winning of a significant battle. And so he said, okay, this is great, then I'm going to be Christian. And when the emperor is Christian, everybody's Christian. Okay, they did not have the separation of church and state that we have here. There, everybody became Christian. And I read part of the edict last week that officially said you have to quit persecuting Christians and taking away their stuff and that they can openly practice and that they can have church and everything. But I said the interesting thing about that is that they also asked the Christians now, because we're letting you practice your religion freely, we want you to pray to your God for us. We want the favor of your God on the Roman Empire and on the political leaders and whatnot. So they were doing fine. Well, one of the things that that Constantine, I think, ran into in this situation is he, and again, I'm speaking for a guy who's long gone and dead, but I'll talk for him anyway. What the heck? You know, he had this vision of this wonderful, united, prosperous Roman Empire. And the way it appears that part of the way that was going to occur was it was going to occur through Christianity. Now that we have a united empire, everybody will be proclaiming the same faith, just like in the olden days in Rome, where they all proclaimed the same sort of pagan faith. Well, now they'll all proclaim Christianity, and everything will be great, and it'll work well for him. Because remember, I've said this a number of times, the most important thing to Rome was peace. And civil organized society, and they only turned on you when you disturbed the peace, and they were brutal at that point. I mean, they would just essentially kill all of the people who were doing the problem. But to Rome, the important thing was peace and everybody getting along and nothing, no big problems. And so that's what Constantine envisioned. And Christianity was a perfect vehicle for that. Now, Constantine was not a theologian. Constantine was not, I think, a very religious man at all. He appears to be highly superstitious and steeped in what we would call the pagan understandings of his day. But he really embraced Christianity through the vision that he had and whatnot. And he actually had a number of Christian leaders, one of the primary bishops there at the time, counsel him and whatnot. But he wasn't a theologian. I don't think he understood that part of the problem now that Christianity was having was a problem with various heresies. Remember we said that Christianity started out, it was very Jewish, and then it had all these Gentiles come in, and then after the fall of Jerusalem and the really, Christianity lost its Jewish connection at that point, and you had more Gentiles than Jews as Christians, and Christianity really became a non-Jewish religion by this point, several hundred years after Pentecost there. And so what happened was as Christianity came out there and started interacting with the world, different things started to happen theologically. One was that Christians were still viewed as a part of Judaism, and then even after they left Judaism, they were still viewed as sort of ignorant, sort of country bumpkin types, you know, superstitious people that really weren't as wise as the great learned people in society, as the philosophers is. And you know, Christians, they didn't read Plato, and they didn't go to the theater, and they didn't have all these things. that was viewed as being a very intelligent sort of cosmopolitan person. And Christians said, well, wait a minute, we're pretty smart folks. We're not just a bunch of yokels here. But they needed to express that to the people that were criticizing him. So Christian apologetics started to say, well, let us show you that our beliefs, our theology, is just as intellectually sound as Platonic philosophy or some of the stuff that the Stoics or some of the other folks that were the folks in Rome would have been familiar with. Second, so one of the things they did was they started to say, well, let's take a look at this. Now Plato is a good example of that. Plato did this. A common view at the time was that there was some sort of supreme being. There was a god or multiple gods, but the belief was that there was no interaction with humankind because they were gods and we're just humans. And so Christians played on this and they said, but now let's take a look at this concept of the Logos. You see, this is that what you really miss, you pagan philosophers, is that, yeah, there is this God, and it's the God that we know, the God of the Bible, and he really does interact with humans, and the way he does it is through the figure of Jesus and this idea of Logos, this Greek idea. And so they use this as a way to say that, look, we're not stupid unintellectuals, we're actually pretty smart folks. Another thing that started to happen was they had to start identifying certain theological beliefs because people were saying, well, wait a minute, the apostles are all gone, the generation of folks who followed the apostles were now gone, so now we have a lot of other folks and we have to make sure we're consistently teaching the same thing generation after generation, so we have to define this stuff a little more clearly. Before, yeah, everybody believed it because you could just go over to John, or after John you could go to Polycarp, or you know, after Polycarp you'd go to Irenaeus. Well, now we're starting to lose these guys, so we have to define theologically. So all this stuff is swirling around. And in the process of this, people who are blending Greco-Roman philosophy and thought with Christianity are coming up with some variations on Christianity that aren't necessarily biblical. Folks who are defining this stuff within the church themselves are defining it in ways that are not consistent with what had been taught before with biblical Christianity. So we start having the rise of these heresies. And most of the time, these heresies were sort of internal arguments. Certainly, nobody was, you know, Marcion came up with his sort of beginning Bible based on his pre-Gnostic beliefs, but nobody really worried about that. That was an in-house discussion. By the time of Athanasius in 367, that was put to bed, and, you know, Marcion's canon from the 140s, 150s, and around in there, that was, nobody used that anymore. Well, some folks, but the Gnostic, to this day, we don't have the first Gnostic Church of Irvine or anything, so, you know, that kind of died out. So that was just sort of a blip on the theological radar. It wasn't impacting society, but there were some big things that were starting to impact society, and the biggest one of these was the discussion of really the relationship between Jesus and God the Father, God the Son and God the Father, and whether Jesus was God in the way that today we would view is the biblical view, that he is the same as God, the same person. This became a big deal. Now, prior to this, there have always been arguments about, I mean, from the time of the New Testament, we can read in the New Testament where the people who say, no, he's not God. I mean, clearly, the folks that reject, the Jewish leadership that rejected Jesus prior to the crucifixion said, no, he's not God and he's not Messiah. Jesus himself clearly claimed to be God within the New Testament. Those that followed after him clearly saw him as God. But you had folks, you had the Ebionites, you had folks who said, no, he's not God, he was just a man. And then you had other folks who said, no, he wasn't a man at all, he was only God, right? And they said that really he was a modalist. They said he was a form of God. It was as if God put on a Halloween costume pretending to be a man and came to earth. And so you had all these arguments, and they centered around whether Jesus was really human or really God or all of one or some. And so this kind of goes along. But when we get up to this period of time now, in around the 4th century and whatnot, we start finding that this controversy over whether Jesus was truly God or not becomes hugely important, okay? And it's not the kind of in-house argument like the some of the earlier little things, some of the Gnostics dust-ups and whatnot. But this starts to become important primarily because of one guy, a guy named Arius. Now, Arius was a bishop, and he was a really influential guy. And he was probably, if we had gotten a chance to hear him, he was probably very charismatic and very the kind of guy that you just really get involved when you heard him talk and when you read his writings and whatnot. And he taught that Jesus was a created being. He said that Jesus was like God, but he was more like a sort of a demigod. He wasn't eternal. Only God the Father was eternal. Now, Arius believed that this was correct because he was defending truly the God of the Bible. And the God of the Bible is eternal. And Arius said, so Jesus can't be eternal because that's reserved only for God. Now, Jesus was important, and he was the first begotten Son of God, but he was still a created being. He wasn't part of the same thing as God. Well, clearly that didn't play well with a lot of folks, because a lot of folks said, no, that's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible teaches that Jesus truly is God, and he's eternal, and all that other stuff. But Arius was so popular that everybody lined up, or a large majority of people lined up on his side and said, yeah, this guy's right. And when the other bishops started coming around saying, no, Arius, that's not right, you're wrong, you started getting these heated theological debates, and they spilled over out the front door of the church into the public square. And you start getting folks on the side of Arius protesting out in public against the folks that were against him. And then the folks who were for the traditional biblical view of Jesus as truly God, fighting and arguing with Arius's followers. And Constantine didn't like that, because this breaks the peace of Rome. So Constantine says, you know what? We've got to do something about this. Okay? Now,
at this stage, Bible had been canonized, right?
At this point in time, yeah. We know that the Bible was... some of this occurred before 367. Let's see. Nicaea was 325. So we know that this occurred before the final word on that. But I have to tell you, if you study how the Bible was formed and the whole process of canonization, that was locked and loaded very early on. And so it was, while there may have been arguments at this point in time of maybe whether the book of Revelation should be in or not, or, well, we're not too crazy about the book of James in some circles, nobody is arguing over Paul's letters. Nobody is arguing over the four Gospels. Nobody is arguing over the book of Acts. This stuff is just, by that time, absolutely set in stone.
And the Old Testament, the same thing?
Yeah, the Old Testament, and I'm going to touch on the Old Testament here in probably about a half hour from now. Okay. So anybody listening on the web or on the CD, you have about a half hour to go get a cup of coffee before I talk about the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. But we'll see in a moment. Yeah, that essentially was a done deal as well on that. So, but what we've got is now we've got these discussions, and I wanted to, you know, it is important to me when we look at history to always, if we can, understand the words of the people that we're talking about. Nothing is more frustrating, this is a personal beef of mine, nothing is more frustrating to me than people who don't use primary sources to validate what they're doing. I found this out early on when I had other believers telling me how I was to respond to, in a particular case, to Mormons. And they said, well, you know, they believe this, this, and this. And I said, well, really? How do I know that? And, well, because we read it in this book. And so I got that book, and I said, well, okay, this guy says they believe that, that, and that, but this guy's a Christian. And while I'm not a Mormon, and I don't agree with their theology, I'm just sharing with you this process, I said, well, shouldn't I go read what the Mormons say about themselves? If I'm going to discuss with them, I probably should go read their own stuff first, just so I get a handle on it, because I don't want to beat up on them if they're wrong, if they're not saying that, but I want to be able to show them where they're wrong if they are saying that. And then when I started my first master's, which I never completed, it was in history, ancient history and religion, and part of what was drummed into me was that you use primary sources as much as you can in history. So when we're talking about these things, and this sometimes happens with Christians, is they read books that were written by somebody who wrote a book after he read another book by somebody else, and they don't use they don't use primary sources. And so I try to, for our class, I try to give you primary sources and read to you what these guys actually said. Now, it doesn't make them right. Arius was wrong. I mean, I'm not an Arian. If I was, I'd be a Jehovah's Witness, because they're Arians. But it's important that you hear what Arius had to say. Now, he wrote a letter to a guy named Eusebius of Nicodemia, and Eusebius is one of the big bishops that support him. This is in 321, so it was right about the time of the Nicene Council. And Arius said, "What we say and think, we both have taught and continue to teach, that the Son is not unbegotten, nor part of the unbegotten in any way, nor is he derived from any substance, but by his own will and counsel he exists before time and ages. Before he was begotten or created or appointed or established, he did not exist." So Arius says that before Jesus was created, and he gives you three variations on that, begotten or created or appointed, depending on your particular view, that he did not exist. We are persecuted because we say that the Son has a beginning, but the God is without beginning. For that reason, we are persecuted, and because we say that he is from what is not, and this we say because he's neither part of God, neither part of God, nor derived from any substance, for this we're persecuted, the rest you know. So Arius is saying, look it, I'm getting beat up over this, saying this, and he's complaining to this other bishop who is one of his big supporters. Well, Arius thought he was right. A lot of people thought he was right. And this caused a real problem. So Constantine said, okay, we need to put an end to this. We need to stop this. And because this is upsetting the public. And, you know, Constantine was not a theologian. He was emperor. He wanted to put it to bed the way Rome put stuff to bed. There's an interesting little passage here. If I can find it real quick, I just thought about this. Okay. Sorry for the delay here. The dead air if you're listening on the CD. There was a guy who was one of the guys that taught Constantine theology. He was a bishop who was Constantine's sort of theological teacher, and he wrote this letter. His name was Hosius, which is interesting because that's very close to what they were a Greek word they were arguing over. Hosius writes to Constantine. He says, "Do not interfere in matters ecclesiastical, church matters, nor give us orders on such questions, but learn about them from us. For into your hands God has put the kingdom, the affairs of his church he's committed to us. If any man stole the empire from you, he would be resisting the ordinance of God. In the same way, you on your part should be afraid, lest in taking upon yourself the government of the church, you incur guilt of a grave offense. Remember, unto Caesar are things that are Caesar's, and unto God are things that are God's." So he was trying to let Constantine know, don't just go out there and start, you know, killing people and throwing them in jail. Let's do this the right way. So Constantine called a church council at a little place called Nicaea. And this was to put to bed this issue of Arius. And they all came down. Now, the common thought is that 318 bishops showed up for this thing. I wouldn't bet the farm on that number. That was a number that a historian in antiquity put because it lined up with a particular numerical idea out of the Old Testament. But we know there were several hundred bishops showed up. Most of them, interestingly enough, from the eastern wing of the church. Not that many from the western wing of the church, because the guys in the west, the Latin church, felt that this was still kind of an eastern problem anyway. But so Constantine calls this, and they all get together, and they hash out a bunch of stuff at the Council of Nicaea. And this lasted for a little period of time. And they hashed out some, you know, some basic ecclesiastical stuff. Gosh, what color robes should we wear at Easter? And, you know, how should we pass the collection? You know, the church stuff. And then they said, okay, now we have to deal with this whole Arius thing. And the supporters of Arius put on a very good presentation. I'm sure their PowerPoint was impeccable at this this church council. And then the folks who were against Arius put on their presentation. And it was pretty much decided by the time all the dust settled that Arius was wrong. And that you were not going to have the teaching that Arius promoted.
Was Arius there at the 19th council?
Yes.
He was.
I'm pretty sure he was. I'm almost certain he was, yeah. Yeah. He, see, now you got me wondering. Well, that's one of those interesting little questions that I just assumed he was, but I hate to say he was if for some reason he wasn't. He was condemned at the council. His teaching was condemned. Seeing if that was addressed directly to him. No, it doesn't say here. This was the letter that came out of the Council of Nicaea in 325 condemning Arius. In the first place, examination was made into the impiety and lawlessness of Arius and his followers in the presence of our most God-beloved sovereign Constantine, the emperor, and it was unanimously decided that his impious opinion should be anathematized. Now, anathema means we're kicking you out, okay? You're officially, that's like the worst thing you can say to a person, the Christian church. The worst thing they could do was to anathematize someone, okay? Yeah, they're excommunicated you, right? And it basically means you are so bad, I am guaranteeing that you're going to hell. That's basically what that means. They use that a lot in big, we'll see in the split between the Eastern Church and the Western Church, both East and West anathematized each other, Pope. The Council of Trent anathematized all the Protestants. That's a big deal. They whip that one out when they really have to punish people. We anathematize together with all the blasphemous sayings and expressions which he has uttered in his blasphemies, affirming that the Son of God is from what is not, and there was a time when he was not, saying also the Son of God. They basically put an end to this. Now, in the textbook that we're looking at for this class, The Story of Christianity by Gonzalez, if you have the one that's all volumes together in one, on page 165, they give the creed that came out of Nicaea, and it was one of the very first big, important creeds that the church said. And if you grew up in a church tradition that said creedal statements, Lutheran, Episcopal, Catholic, this will sound very familiar to you. In 320, when did this? This is 325. This came out. They said, "We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of all things visible and invisible, and in one Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the only begotten of the Father, that is, from the substance of the Father, not made of one substance with the Father." That was the statement, okay? So they said that Jesus was not made, he was eternal, and he had the same substance as the Father, okay? A side note on how theological arguments can be so thinly sliced. Not that this would ever happen today, mind you, but in the olden days. They were arguing over one letter in one word. Literally, okay? The Greek word for same substance and similar substance differs by one letter. In English, the letter I. In Greek, it's a iota. And again, I pick up the one that doesn't write. Okay, let's try this. This is the word homoousios that means the same substance. Arius and his guys wanted this word, homoiousios. Notice the only difference is this little letter right here. This means similar substance. Okay? So you can see from Constantine's point of view, what are these guys doing? They are ruining the peace. I hope I spelled that correctly. They are ruining the peace over one letter. You know, we need to stop this, right? So Constantine was very happy that that the council did this. And then at the end of the council, now this is interesting. Arius used to say his sort of tagline was, the Arian motto was, there was when he was not, meaning Jesus wasn't eternal. That was their marketing slogan. It was on all their t-shirts and hats and everything. There was when he was not. The Council of Nicaea puts out their creed, and then at the end of the statement they see this. But those who say that there was when he was not, and that before being begotten he was not, or that he came from that which is not, or that the Son of God is different of substance or essence, or that he is created or mutable, these the Catholic Church anathematizes. So they used his own slogan to slap him down. Church people just love beating each other up. So anyway, effectively, for the time being, the peace was held in Rome. Arius was shot down, and I've been sort of tongue-in-cheek on this, legitimately, the biblical teaching of the truth that Christ is eternal member of the Godhead was verified and proven true by the church, okay? So as much as I joke about this stuff and kind of presenting these guys as a little nutty, that was an important hand of God in the history of the church in solidifying biblical truth at the Council of Nicaea. Now, Arius was not done. He was still very popular, and when the word got out that the Arian beliefs were shot down by the formal council and for the church, they still kept teaching it. And in fact, Arius and his followers were really good missionaries, and they got permission to leave the empire and go to the barbarians and teach the barbarians Christianity. And so on the good side, Arius and his little missionary folks brought Christianity to the barbarians. We'll see that later on when the barbarians come in and sack Rome. But he...
Who were the barbarians?
Specifically, they went north to the German area, which would have been the Goths. Right? And it was, because the funny thing is, and they accepted Christianity, you know, that the barbarians liked Christianity. They were fine with it, but they were taught the Arius version of Christianity. So they were Arians, and when they came back in, and when the barbarians and everybody came back in and destroyed Rome and took over prior at the beginning of the Middle Ages, well, the Goths brought Arian Christianity back into vogue again.
Is that word Arians the word that the Germans use? No,
it's a completely different. Arian, in this case, Arian is drawn from the name Arius. Arian, as in the north, or where they actually back through way back when Indo-European in the history, Arians were the northern white race that came in primarily in through Europe. And that's actually spelled with a Y, whereas Arian is A-I, and so it's a different thing.
Okay, so it's a race of people.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. The Arians were a race of people. Arians, in theological Arians, are folks who followed Arius.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, to this day, you know, if you hang out with Goths, they're still Arian Christians. You know, those dark-haired teenagers that wear black lipstick.
Right.
No, they're not. Those usually aren't anything. But the folks today that are still promoting Arianism is the Watchtower Bible and Tract Society. Jehovah's Witness. Well, Mormons do, but not in the traditional sense. Mormons have a completely different view that Jesus was one of the spirit children of Father God, Father and Mother God, and that Jesus, whose brother, by the way, was Satan, had this big battle as to who was going to come down to this world. And so they're a slightly different version of this. The Jehovah's Witnesses are very close in their theology to what Arius taught. So this is not something that, again, simply ended back in 325. We still find it today. So you have that. Now, Again, now, since Rome is kind of now quiet and calm and everything's okay and the big heresies are sort of wiped out, it looks like we're doing fine, and then Constantine dies. Okay? Now, part of Constantine's legacy was that the church acquired a lot of the trappings of Roman aristocracy. That Roman senators and priests in the Christian church were revered in society, and the dress was very similar. Interestingly enough, there are still parts of the formal religious wear that you will find in Catholic and Orthodox churches today that you can date fashion-wise back to this period of time even. But the structure of the church, everything really became very Roman, even in the West, even in the East, not just in the West. Remember, the Christian church at this time was not split. It had two wings, one in the East, up out of Constantinople in that area, and the other in the West, out of Rome. But they were both equal. They hadn't split. There was no dominance of either one. And so the church became very citified and very much like Roman society, which is still part of what we're having to deal with today. There's still issues that in the church today that we can trace all the way back to this time. Because again, when you quit being the folks who were forced to be in the outside of town meeting in a tent because everybody was persecuting you, when you suddenly become the big building right downtown next to the emperor's palace, you change and you take on some stuff that you probably shouldn't. But then Constantine died, and there, you know, his kids didn't do a real good job. They were kind of battling. Romans have never been really good at smooth succession from one group to the next. And a guy named Julian finally came up. He was, I think, a nephew of Constantine. He wasn't one of his direct descendants. Anyway, Julian ends up winning out. And Julian is gone through history now with the title of Julian the Apostate. Okay, Julian was a guy who said, "I am not Christian. I don't like Christians, and what my whole goal is I want to return Rome to its glorious days of when it was the mighty Roman Republic. And part of that means I want to bring back paganism to downtown." You see, at the time that Julian came up, if you were well-fed and had a lot of money and you were religious, you were a Christian priest or a bishop. If you were in poverty and rags and out of work and couldn't have enough food to feed yourself, you were a pagan priest. Because what Constantine had done and what the people did under Constantine is they went to all the pagan temples and they took all the good stuff and they brought it over to the religion, over to the current religion, which was Christianity. I had a history prof in as an undergraduate who used to always laugh, and he said, if you go to a lot of those really nice churches in around Italy and Rome, the slabs of marble that the altar are made out of were probably benches taken out of the Colosseum that used to have semi-naked Roman behinds on them. So that's kind of how history changes. I thought he was probably being a little bit over top of that, but it's kind of a funny thing to think about. They took all the stuff out of the temples and made it Christian. And so Julian the Apostate comes along and says, no, we're going to revive the great glory that was Rome. And part of that space. So he wants to now rebuild all the pagan temples. And he wants to get all that stuff back that the Christians had taken. And he wants the pagan priests now to have nice robes and food and money and all this stuff. So he goes about to do this. Now, he realizes that Christianity is so entrenched, and there are so many people in the empire who are Christian, that if he goes back to the old days of persecuting and killing Christians, that's going to destroy the social fabric. And again, you know, in Rome, the preserving the peace and the social fabric is the most important thing. So Julian sets out to say, well, we're going to have all this stuff together. Everybody's going to get along. I'm going to really pump up all this stuff over here. Now, along the way, he's trashing Christianity. He's saying that they're a bunch of idiots, they're all wrong, these heresies prove that Christians don't know what they're doing, but he's not persecuting anyone. Julian is not killing Christians. Christians are persecuted during his time, but it's by other Romans who are trying to help build back up pagan Rome. And they take it into their own hands to go into town and kill the Christians. But Julian is not doing this. In fact, Julian is real interesting. His There's two things that I really get a kick out of hearing Julian. Now, I have to tell you, this is even more interesting to me. Today, as I was driving, I was behind a car with a guy who had a bumper sticker. I hope none of you have this bumper sticker, because I'm going to make fun of it, and I don't mean to make fun of any of you if you have this bumper sticker. But it says coexist, and each letter in the bumper sticker is a different religious symbol. Okay. I agree with that sentiment completely. I have no interest in going out and getting a baseball bat and beating up any Zoroastrians or Buddhists or anybody. I will get along with everybody. My neighborhood that I happen to live in, I'm Protestant. I got Catholics on either side of me. I have a Buddhist two doors down. I have a Sikh three doors down on the other side. I have no problem coexisting with other religions. I just found this to be a wonderful little naive bumper sticker. To boot, what I loved about this guy was he was a guy, probably mid-30s, white guy, driving like an idiot, riding the tail of the car in front of him. You know, he's all upset, whipping in and out. And I thought, wow, dude, coexist, you know. But he clearly wasn't. So, but what's interesting about this is that idea, this new idea that we need to have everybody equal, and we all need to just get along and coexist, and it's okay, you're really just as good as mine, and you're just as okay as mine, goes all the way back to Julian's time. When you read what Julian said about paganism and Christianity working together, he didn't like cheek. He said, "Future, let the people live in harmony. Let no one be at variance or do wrong to another. Neither you that are in error," meaning the Christians, "or those who worship the gods, as is right and proper," meaning the pagan gods, "in the manner handed down from earliest antiquity, nor let the worshippers of the gods destroy nor plunder the house of those who are misled by their ignorance, rather than deliberate or by choice. Men should be taught and won over by reason, not by blows, insults, or corporal punishment. I therefore most earnestly admonish their adherents of the true religion not to injure or insult the Galileans," that was his term for Christians, "in any way, either by physical attack or reproaches. Let those who are in the wrong in matters of supreme importance be objects of pity rather than of hate." And that's sort of damning you with faint praise there, right? But that was Julian's idea. And I get a kick because occasionally you'll read strong anti-Christian things where they're claiming that all Christians are just, you know, radical nut jobs who want to kill everybody that doesn't believe like they do, and they sound real similar to the way Julian said here. Now, Julian went on to talk about his own theology and to point out why Christianity is wrong. He said, "But you, unfortunately, do not abide by the tradition of the apostles themselves, which in the hands of their successors had deteriorated into great blasphemy. Neither Paul nor Matthew nor Luke nor Mark had the audacity to say that Jesus is God. But the worthy John, realizing that by his time a vast number of people in many of the Greek and Italian cities were infected with this disease, I fancy that the tombs of Peter and Paul were being worshipped. John, I say, was the first to make this assertion that Jesus was God." So Julian goes on to give his Bible study that none of these great Christian writers ever said Jesus was God. It was these nutty folks that came after him. So Julian takes over. And so you got the heresies kind of put to bed, and then Julian comes back with all his pagan stuff. And Christianity is still doing okay, though. Julian.
Was Julian better versed? I know he wasn't a believer, but theologically better versed than Constantine? I mean, did he have a more deeper understanding of Christianity? I know he wasn't a believer.
No, I don't think that he had a better the question is whether Julian had a better theological understanding than Constantine. I don't think he did. I think what happened, Constantine was a great Roman guy. He was an excellent military guy. He was a good Roman politician. And he had the counsel of good religious men. Hosius was one of them, who said, "Okay, I'm going to show you about what Christianity really teaches." So Constantine had good teaching. Whether he fully got it or not, or chose to embrace it, we don't know. Now, Julian, on the other hand, was a really smart guy. He outmaneuvered Constantine's kids to get the emperor seat. So he was a really wise, good, smart politician. And he was a really smart guy, and he was well-versed in what we would call the pagan learning of the day, the great philosophies and the teaching of the different mystery religions and whatnot at the time. And he was smart enough to understand that I get this whole Christianity thing and this whole Bible thing. I'm going to manipulate that to prove that these Christians are dumb by using their own works to show this. One of the things, interestingly, that Julian did, the thought was, and it's correct theologically, that Jerusalem was destroyed by Rome as punishment, right? That was the unpardonable sin, was rejection of Messiah by the Jews, and so the punishment from God was the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem. That's theologically correct. Julian said, wait a minute, everybody's saying that. Well, I can prove them wrong. I'll go down and rebuild the temple. So Julian puts into play a plan to rebuild the temple in Jerusalem. Because clearly, if Rome rebuilds the temple, then there's no way you can run around and say, well, this proves what the Old Testament said, right? Well, he never gets a chance to do that. Julian ends up getting killed. He gets in a battle with the Persians, and one of their little lances happens to go through him, and Julian's gone before he could do any of this stuff. And that was really the last significant opposition to Christianity from outside that has occurred. So from Julian's death forward, Christianity really was in the driver's seat. And Julian really didn't do any damage anyway. I mean, it was a little blip on the screen. He gets tagged as the apostate forever by his name in the history books. But that was really the end of it. Christianity, up until today, never saw the kind of persecution again that we saw under Nero. Today, Christianity is brutally persecuted in any one of the stands, mm-hmm. Kyrgyzstan, any of the stands. In parts of China, in parts of Africa, Christians are slaughtered. Okay, but from Julian's time forward up until more of a modern period, we just don't see the kind of wholesale slaughter of Christianity. What we do is we see Christianity gradually becoming the powerful political, social, and theological entity that the church really became that was finally attacked. Well, started to be attacked in the 14th century, was finally attacked in the Reformation when we get to that. I want to talk about two important figures during this period of time that's important for understanding church history. These are two names that you hear, and I want to talk about them, put them in context. Jerome and Augustine. Augustine is really important because, well, one, he was a brilliant guy. He was just a card-carrying pagan. He was a sinner that really loved to sin. When you read Augustine's, the Confessions of St. Augustine, this guy knew how to party, okay? He was more than happy to be out there just wine, women, and song every night. Much to the dismay of his poor mother, who prayed and prayed and prayed for her son to be converted. But Augustine was brilliant. And when he became a Christian, he became, as much as he was a full-fledged party guy, he was a full-fledged Christian when he became. And Augustine, significantly out of this period of time, the thing that still affects through the Reformation is his discussion and arguments against a guy named Pelagius. Now, I'll talk about this later. Pelagius basically taught that there was no such thing as the sin nature in mankind, and there was no such thing as imputed or inherited sin, that Adam sinned and Adam sinned alone. That every man is born brand new and that we have the choice to either sin against God or follow in our own way. Well, right off the bat, that tells you that nullifies the need for the finished work of Christ on the cross. If I can just be a good guy myself, I don't need the complete sacrifice of Jesus. So it was a dangerous and terrible heresy that Pelagius taught. And Augustine argued strongly against it. And he was instrumental in Pelagius being viewed as a heretic and later on at a church council. Interestingly enough, the Christian church adopted a semi-Pelagianist view, despite what Augustine was saying. And to this day, Christianity in the form of Roman Christianity is semi-Pelagian. Roman Catholics are semi-Pelagian. They're not fully Pelagian. They don't like that, by the way. If you do run into a Catholic friend or family member and say, oh, I was just this guy said you guys are semi-Pelagian, well, they'll tell you I'm an idiot and that I'm completely wrong and that they're not. That's a whole other argument that we'll find out later on. But Augustine was trying, and he was a guy who went from pagan to Christian, and to this day, Augustine is one of the great theologians in the church, whether we agree with him completely or not. And my big beef with Augustine is he started out as a literal understanding of Scripture, and then he switched about midway through his life to an allegorical understanding of Scripture. It is unfortunate that his allegorical understanding of Scripture is what stayed, and people still to this day follow that, and it's a flat-out wrong way to approach Scripture. But Augustine was a great guy. The other guy is a personal favorite of mine. He's also a big name, a guy named Jerome. And I said I was going to talk about the Old Testament. I'm going to finish up tonight with this. Jerome was born around the same time as Augustine. Jerome was, I don't know, Jerome was like 320, 325 to about 4 something. He was off by about 10 years off of Augustine's dates. They were similar periods of time. And Jerome was brilliant. Now, he was born to a Christian family. And so unlike Augustine, who was this just, you know, party guy, Jerome was they said he was born an old man. He was this brilliant scholar, and the big awakening in his life happened when he had a vision that he had died and gone before the throne of God. Now, Jerome was a brilliant guy, and he was passionate and about learning. And about all learning, not just Christian stuff, but he was so well versed in the philosophy and teachings of his day, Greco-Roman philosophical ideas and everyone, that in his dream, when he stood before God, God said, "Who are you and what are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm Jerome and I'm a Christian." And God said, "No, you're not. You're a Ciceronian," meaning, you know, you're one of these pagan philosopher guys, you know. And that was a huge deal to Jerome. So from that point, he said, "I need to turn my life around." And so he actually decided that, well, he had a little problem with, he felt he was far too attracted to the ladies, and so he went out to the desert to live by himself. Unfortunately, the sort of the thoughts of the ladies and the dancers in around Rome and everything kind of followed him, and you can't give that stuff out of your brain too easily, and so he was still dealing with that. And he also really didn't like living out in a cave in the desert. That just wasn't his deal. So he came back. But the thing that Jerome did that he's known, in my opinion, it's the biggest thing that he did, is Jerome is one of the key men in the transmission of the Bible. Okay? The Old Testament was written in Hebrew, and then it was translated into Greek hundreds of years before Jesus came along. And the version of the Old Testament that was translated into Greek was called the Septuagint. I've talked about that before in other classes. It gets that name. Septuagint is the Roman number for 70. And in fact, when you see the Septuagint most of the time written in literature, the abbreviation is the Roman numeral for 70, LXX. And basically, it was that 70 scribes all took... they went into separate tents at the exact same time to translate the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek, and they all got done at the exact same time. They all came out at the same time, and when you laid all their translations out side by each on the tables, they were exactly the same, and that was a sign that God had blessed that translation. That's why it's called the Septuagint, or the 70. Anyway, you know, that's a nice rabbinical story. It probably wasn't true. But so you have this Greek translation of the Old Testament. That was what most Christians used. Okay, in fact, in the New Testament, whenever the New Testament authors quote the Old Testament, they're quoting out of the Septuagint. You can tell because you can tell that they're quoting directly from a Greek text as opposed to translating from a Hebrew text into Greek. The New Testament was written in Greek. Okay, now, 90 AD, Rome destroys the temple, Jerusalem's sacked. The rabbis have to decide, how can we be Jewish because we don't have a temple anymore. 70 AD was when it destroyed. 90 AD, the rabbis got together in a little joint called Yamnia, and they all decided that we have to define what Judaism is going to look like without a temple. And part of that is that we're going to be slaves to God's word, because that's what we have left. So they decided in 90 AD that what the Old Testament would be, see, I told you about a half hour I was going to talk about the Old Testament, that what the Old Testament was going to be was it was going to be only the books written by Hebrew prophets in Hebrew. And they got rid of the Greek translation. Okay, so that's what the Jews said. This is the Old Testament. Okay, Christians on the other side, they kept their Greek translation because everybody spoke Greek, right? Christians all spoke Greek. Well, around the time of Jerome, not everybody spoke Greek anymore. In fact, the Western wing of the church spoke Latin, okay? Latin had been around for a long time, but it really was the common language of the day. So the church said, we need a translation of the Bible in the common language of the day. And they hired Jerome to do it, because the guy was brilliant. So Jerome translated the entire Bible from Greek into Latin. His version of the Bible in Latin is called the Vulgate. It comes from the Latin word vulgaris, which means common. Not vulgar, as in when we say the word vulgar, it means it's like ugly or disgusting. That's actually a slightly different Latin word. But they called it the common translation, the Vulgate. And it was the translation from Greek into Latin. That was a huge thing. But interestingly enough, what Jerome did, and this is what I think was so fascinating, Jerome really argued with the church at the time. Jerome, part of how Jerome, when he went out in the desert to forget the visions of the Roman dancing girls that were plaguing him, is he just said, well, I got to do something to take my mind off of these images of these women. I'm going to learn Hebrew because that'll keep me really busy and I won't be able to think of the dancing girls. And remember, they didn't have the Rosetta Stone or computer software back then to make this easy, right? He had to really learn it himself. Well, he did. He became a master of Hebrew. And as Jerome was making his translation of the Bible, the New Testament was easy because it was all in Greek. So that was no problem. But he said, wait a minute. There's the Jews believe that the Old Testament should just be these Hebrew books. But in his copy of the Old Testament that he was using, there were other books there that weren't in the Hebrew. You see, over the period of time, the Septuagint, people had added to the Old Testament. They added a bunch of other books in there. Some of them were historical books. Some of them were wisdom literature and religious kind of things. Some were, there's one really cool story about Tobit, about a blind guy getting married and everything. And all this stuff got bundled in there. Well, Jerome said, wait a minute. This isn't what the Jews say the Old Testament is. And you know, the Jewish people were given responsibility for the oracles of God. Well, we should make our Bible only based on what the Jews believe, on this Hebrew Old Testament, and I don't want to translate all these extra books that snuck into the Greek Old Testament. Well, the church didn't like that, and they told Jerome, you got two choices. You either translate it with the Bible we've been using, which has all these other books in there, or we're going to really punish you bad. Now, Jerome is a wise man and says, okay, I'll translate it the way you want. But he argued against the inclusion of these extra books in the Old Testament. We'll find that in a couple of weeks, when we get to the Reformation, one of the big arguments out of the Reformation was what the real Bible was supposed to be. And it was arguing over these books that were in the Greek Old Testament, not in the Hebrew, that came to a fever pitch during the time of the Reformation. To this day, Catholic-produced Bibles from Catholic publishing houses will have those extra books. Bibles that Protestants use from Protestant publishing houses will not. If you have a Catholic friend and they have a New American, what they call the New American, not the New American Standard, just the New American Bible, or a Jerusalem Bible, those are the two most common, it will have 11 more books. Well, parts of some books are folded into others. No, there's 11 total. Some are extra books, some are folded, stories are folded into like the book of Daniel and whatnot. But it will be different in the Old Testament than if you have a Bible that comes from Zondervan or some of these other folks, right? So, and this was an issue that started back with Jerome. And he argued, I believe correctly so, that we should stay with only those books that the Council of Yomnia said were the true Old Testament books. Now, this won't become an issue again until we get up to the Reformation. But Jerome, the seeds of that problem were started back here with Jerome's translation of the Old Testament. That gets us up to pretty much where we need to be. Next week, we'll talk about the Vandals and the Goths and the barbarian hordes that came in and sacked Rome. We'll find out that the office of Pope takes on huge importance next time. The Pope at the time had a wonderful little meeting with Attila the Hun and kept him from coming in and wiping out Rome. So the Pope at the time, Pope Leo, did a really good job protecting Rome from Attila the Hun. And then we're going to take a look also at the split between the Eastern and Western wings of the church, which is just one of the things I just have to laugh over, the how stupid religious people are in battling with each other. I had a pastor for a long time that said Christians are the only army that shoots its own soldiers. And albeit these guys were arguing over some fairly important stuff, but the way they did it was just absurd. And so we'll look at the split between the Eastern Church and the Western Church and get us on track so that in a couple of weeks we can spend a little time looking at the Reformation. Any questions? All right. I'll see y'all next week.